What's up, everybody? My name is Matt Story, and I'm the host of What's Your Story podcast, where I get to sit with leaders from all different fields and industries to learn how their experience as a person of color has helped them to blaze a new trail and make a unique impact on our world. Today's guest is Nash Ahmed, CEO and founder of Undock. Nash's story is one that's truly interesting. It starts with him being told as a teenager that he could no longer play the competitive sports that he loved, all the way up to being a startup founder and being told that he wasn't ready and that VCs weren't going to be able to invest in him because of the stage he was at. But what I really appreciated was when Nash opened up about his experiences growing up with a single mother and seeing firsthand the sacrifices that she made on behalf of him and his siblings to ensure that they would have possibilities that she didn't have in her life. And it was really interesting to learn about the tough situations that he had to navigate that prepared him for the hardships in life that he would be able to work through and also become successful on the other side of. So let's get on to his story. All right. So today's guest is a serial telecom executive that set out to help build the future of work as he's now the CEO and founder of Undock, which for those that aren't familiar, is an AI-enabled meeting platform. So with that, I'd like to welcome Nash Ahmed to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show program, Matt.
Thank you for joining, brother. So before we start, can you just give a little bit of background on, I saw that you had history in the music production world and performances, so I'd love it if you could just share How was your experience in the music industry?
My experience in the music industry was up and down. I started just by producing a little bit in college just as a hobby. I also did a little bit of rapping on occasion, but I was mostly producing and producing for other artists. And I think in my sophomore and junior year, there were a few chance connections that we made, so as a group, and we ended up producing for like Lil Wayne, Dipset, Fabolous, Ashanti, Lloyd, a lot of famous artists in the, you know, early to late 2000s. We produced tracks for, and it was 2007. Those were the ups, right? Okay. And then 2007. After we did some track for Jim Jones, I can't remember which one it was that he really liked, and he was about to come out with his album after the song Ballin' was taking over the airwaves, and he invited us out as a collective to produce his entire album.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was great. And then we show up there the first day, it's in Hollywood, and they're like, oh yeah, he's coming, just go meet us at this nightclub instead of the studio. I'm like, I'm here to work. All right, so we get there, we're in the VIP, and I was like, all right, so when are we going to the studio? I was like, I don't know, man, we're just hanging out right now. And that was essentially the entire story for, I think I was there for almost a month waiting around for this to happen. Wow. And then I came back, and that was late 2007, and it was like, maybe this music industry is not going to be something that you can rely on. Like, but we did make some, you know, good inroads, worked with some big names, got paid some good money at times, other times didn't get paid. That's the other downside of it. But I couldn't see it growing into like really stable, large form of income, except for like the select few producers out there that, you know, make a really good living off of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Your description of it has its ups and its downs is very spot on based on that quick story. So to go back a little bit to how you started out and, you know, thinking about what little Nash was like growing up, could you share a little bit about that experience?
Yes. I was a serial athlete before I was a serial telecom executive. I played soccer and basketball pretty much every year, starting in like the third grade, I believe, and did pretty well. Was making travel teams and state teams. And then for soccer, I was even being recruited to play for older divisions than I was. But then around 12 or 13, that actually happened in basketball too. I made a travel basketball team, which I was too young to play on. But around 12 or 13, I was playing in a basketball game and I had a reaction, didn't know what it was. I thought it may have been a reaction to like detergent or something like that.
Yeah.
Didn't think anything of it. Then it happened again at the next basketball game. Then I started taking a battery of tests and couldn't figure it out. And it was determined that I have exercise-induced anaphylaxis, which is a condition in which you can go into anaphylactic shock if you exercise too much.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So I talked to my doctor, or I guess my doctor talked to me and said, hey, so my best advice for you, because this particular diagnosis, you can go look up, do whatever research. There's not much known about what you can do to avoid this as an athlete. So he said, what we recommend if you want to continue to be an athlete is to pick up these two sports. And it was hilarious. Number one, I was very short until about ninth grade, even though I was still playing basketball. I was a point guard. And I was very skinny. I'm still very skinny. Well, not after the quarantine, but after the quarantine 15 that I put on, I was a very skinny individual. These are the two options that he gave me to continue my athletic career. Also, well, I'll give you the two options. Weightlifting and swimming. I'm like, no. Like, look at me. Look at me. Young, skinny, black boy from, well, from originally from Nigeria, but, you know, the slums of New Jersey, is not swimming and is not picking up weightlifting. And I ended up taking 2 years, a little over 2 years, away from those sports that I loved and it was the only thing that I knew. And that I thought at maybe some point, I was definitely going to play in college if I kept on the trajectory, and who knows how well you advance. Once you get to college, like the pool is like so intense that your chances of advancing to the next level are next to none. But I know I was definitely going to play something in college. But I took a couple years off, and then I started thinking, you know, I at the very least wanted to be a varsity athlete. Like, even though I don't make it to college, I want to be a varsity athlete. So my senior year, after not playing in high school at all, I went out to try out for the varsity soccer team. And it was also after a 2 year hiatus from playing any sports. And I made the team. And it was kind of like a defining moment that even if you're told you can't do something, in this case by a medical professional, you can figure your way out to get around it. So for me, it was about controlling and knowing the onset and the symptoms and then asking out whenever I needed to ask out. And that's what I did. And I was able to play. I also picked up hockey in that time frame too, which is interesting. But that was me. I thought I was going to be an athlete at least through college. And then in ninth grade, it was like, nope, not happening. And that's when I started thinking more about like business. Being a businessman became a thing for me. And shortly thereafter, like mid junior year to senior year, I started thinking about technology as a path, just like, you know, and for us, and this is the, like the mid to late 90s, like technology is just becoming like an everyday thing in the world. So those two things became my thing and it sort of converged by the time I got to college. That was dead set on being a businessman. But it was a little bit too ambiguous for me to like take a business management degree or an accounting degree or something like that. So I chose to get a computer science degree and minor in business management and psychology.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. I feel like those are three pillars to doing pretty much anything in business. But I do want to go back, being at that age, which many of us probably feel, one, invincible, and two, feeling like we can take on the world. I'm curious, what did you draw on to like not be deterred and not to take like a completely spiral in what you previously had thought was where you're going to go and to put that energy and that effort into something that was probably just as, if not more productive, which eventually would become your you know, schooling and career. I'm curious, where did that come from, or where do you think you drew from that perspective?
Oh, I'll tell you, I was deterred, and I've always been like an emotionally strong person. So I wasn't deterred in the emotional sense. I was kind of deterred in like, all right, then what am I going to do sense? And I'll tell you, I didn't mention like prior to that diagnosis, I was also pretty good academic. I was like in all the gifted and talented programs and all other stuff. And I actually started to lose interest in that because I was pushed so hard on it early that I was like, because that was the original, original path. It's like, yeah, you're going to be a doctor or a scientist or something like that. Like I had an algebra tutor in like the fifth grade that my mom got for me because my guidance counselor said that I was bored with the coursework that I was getting. Thank you, guidance counselors. Yeah, I did not enjoy having an algebra tutor in fifth and sixth and seventh grade. And I started to lose interest in school. I was focusing more on sports. I just loved playing sports. I was playing a sport year round. Yeah. Soccer, basketball, picked up hockey, tried to learn golf a little bit. But at that moment, it's kind of a blur. Like, I don't know what my core interest was in ninth grade and 10th grade. I dropped out of the band as well. I was on the track team leading up to that too. I didn't do track in the ninth grade. I dropped out of the band in the ninth grade. I let my grades slip because I just didn't care too much about schooling. And I actually developed sometime between like the seventh and ninth grade, I developed this mindset, and I may be wrong or I may have been right, that schooling, the way it's built right now, is fundamentally wrong for most people, in that everyone has to learn at the same pace. And that's to no one's advantage, not to the quick learners or to the people that need a little bit more time to learn. And the idea that you spend, 8 hours a day in a class, in a school, jumping from classroom to classroom, not necessarily learning practical things, just blows my mind. For 12 years, right? Someone like me, I could have probably, here's the deal. So I could have probably gotten through school in 7 years or something like that, right? And then someone else that may have a different learning style, it doesn't mean that it would take them the full 12 years. You just need to work with their learning style. And it might take them 7 or 8 years. It just seems completely inefficient to teach everyone the exact same way in classes of 12 to 20 or 25 based on their age and not their ability or learning style. So,
yeah, you've backed into one of my soapbox topics in schooling, because I couldn't agree more that it's fundamentally not designed to be optimal for anyone. It's almost like we've generalized it over the years. And, you can get into the history of like education system was designed to create manufacturer workers, and it was designed to create people to work on a assembly line. And we have not changed it. We've changed the topics and we've changed the content, but the actual system with which that content is delivered has not changed and has not adapted as many things around us have changed drastically. We're probably two generations away from what it was designed for. So I 100% agree with everything.
Absolutely.
You're referencing, especially as someone that has, young kids. I just feel like we try to optimize it for them, but you can only do so much in a system that's broken. So I expect it's going to change, especially given now what we're seeing with learning from home. And, I think a lot of parents have questioned, is this really the best way for their kids to learn? And so I think we're going to see a lot of that coming through in the day in and day out kind of approach to schooling over the next few years.
Yeah, I think online schooling and homeschooling is going to be, I'm going to say never, it's not going to take over even when we go back, but it's going to be a large enough industry. And that's how you have to start thinking about some of these things. It'll be a large enough industry for innovation to take place and disruption to take place. And it's definitely, definitely going to happen.
Yeah. So there's another thing you hit on in your background story. You mentioned that you were born in Nigeria, but then grew up in New Jersey. So I'd love to hear more about kind of that transition and how was that for you growing up?
Absolutely. So I was born in Nigeria. I don't remember anything. I moved here. I was a year and a half or maybe 2 years old. And we moved to Trenton, New Jersey. I'll look it up. And that's where we started. It was the four of us in a one-bedroom apartment, which almost – I still remember that apartment. I actually can remember for some odd reason, the shape, the size, everything about it. It was a one-bedroom apartment. A lot of memories from that time frame, but it was definitely tough. But at that age, you don't understand that it's tough. You don't understand that four people in a bed is not normal, right? So you just deal with it. You don't understand that drinking or eating cereal, nameless cereal, brandless cereal with water is not normal, right? Yeah. But you think back on it, you look back on it, you're like, yeah, that was, those were tough, trying times. But my mother is an exemplary workhorse, and she lifted us up out of that. And we moved to a town called Ewing, New Jersey. And that time we joined forces, I'll say, with my father for a few years, but that didn't end up working out. So then we were back out on our own to West Trenton, New Jersey. Slightly better living situation, but still a one-bedroom apartment with four people. Yeah. So for, let's see, 1995 through 2000, for 5 years, one-bedroom apartment, me, my mother, my two sisters. My two sisters took the bedroom. I slept in the dining room, and my mother slept in the living room. She had a pull-out futon sofa as her bed for 5 years. So I think when you, people say humble beginnings, when you start off there, but that is okay to you as you're experiencing it, like it's transformative when you move into the next, like anything, like one, one tiny footstep up, you're like, wow, this is great. This is amazing. This is like, and you just appreciate things a lot more. And it makes you work harder for the things that you have or the things that you're trying to achieve because you understand what it's like to be or to not have it. And it's not that far away from you. I remember almost everything vividly beyond like the age of 10 or 11. I can picture specific days, things that happened on whatever days, what I was wearing, like, you know, or having holes in your clothes and stuff like that. I remember those things. So you can always point back to that and just be thankful and grateful for what you have, but also know that if you can climb from, and I didn't do any of that climbing during that time, that's all my mother. If my mother can climb as a single parent from where we started to where she put three children through college, essentially by herself, working two jobs, one as a teacher and the second as a housekeeping at a Marriott hotel or Ramada. Actually, it was most of the time I think she spent on a night shift. You know that you can do things too, and that your parent has given up a lot and sacrificed a lot to put you in a position to not rest on your laurels, to not say, oh, I have this and now I'm okay. It's like, no, we started here. Your mom bootstrapped everything and got you to the next level, but now you need to keep going. And every single one of her children are extremely, well, I'm not saying it about myself, her other two children are extremely successful, and that's completely attributable to what she did. So, like, even though we were, you know, probably considered latchkey kids for a few years because she would go to work, come home, change, go back to work, come back in the middle of the night, whatever. But we all saw that, and then she does have, and she did have, conversations that just instilled, like, work ethic. And like you are, and this is something you really don't understand. I don't even know if she really understood it back then, but she would always say, you are a black man in America. So understand, she's saying this to me at 10, 11, 12. Understand that no matter what you do, you have to be smarter, you have to be better, and you have to be more polite than everyone else just to even get a look.
Yeah. Yeah, no. One, thank you for sharing that because it definitely, it speaks to, I think, you know, if I had to put it in one word, perspective. And you having that perspective, it like lays the foundation for who you are as a person. And I'll say it on your behalf. You are successful. You'll probably continue to be successful and have many more things to point to. But that only is capable because of someone putting you in that position, and in this case being your mother. It's something that speaks to me very, very heartfelt, because my mother, while I don't try to compare or say it's a similar situation, but growing up in a single parent household, there's just certain things that you experience. And I think that your point about it, that you didn't realize it wasn't normal. You didn't realize this wasn't a shared experience that your classmates had until you do that. And I remember growing up in an apartment and not having your own room and not having, you know, a yard to play in and not having many of these things that my classmates, you know, had in abundance. And I had moments where it was I was embarrassed, and I felt I don't want you to come to my house. I'll come to your house. And as my mom moved through the ranks, she was able to do well, and ultimately she bought a home. And it changed my trajectory and what I was able to do. I don't know that I thought about it at that time, at a 13-year-old, but seeing the sacrifice, seeing what she was going without to be able to do that, just totally is something I look back on very fondly. It instilled into me that work ethic. So I can appreciate that. And also, it's just something I think it's important for people to know that's how many of us have, I'll say the word, but we've made it through tougher times, so that when you're sitting in front of, you're sitting in a boardroom, you're sitting in whatever meeting, you're sitting in front of investors, what have you, like I've been through much worse. Yeah. And so I think it's important for people to both know that and also be able to understand that is integral to why people like you are successful.
Well, thank you for sharing that. That gave me a bit of goosebumps hearing that story, because especially the part about your mother being able to get a house, and then also like looking at other people and saying like, oh, well, I'll go to your house instead of you come there. There was, and I don't think it could be scripted any better. It was the apartment complex that we lived in was literally right up against these really big houses where a lot of people from our school lived. Mm-hmm. And it was separated. So there was a basketball court that was part of our apartment complex. And there was these woods. And there's a small path through the woods. And then you walk through that small path through the woods. And there's a huge green grassy patch. Mm-hmm. And then you walk up that hill. And then you'd see all these big houses. And it's like the haves and the have-nots. Like, it was a caricature of the haves and the have-nots. They're literally right next to each other. And I know that they're living a completely different lifestyle. And when you go into their houses for the first time and you look up, and you're like, oh, what? Is that a balcony inside? I don't even know what that is. Like, wow. Yeah. How? All right. Yeah. So there was, I actually wrote a song about that, which maybe at some point, maybe when I'm 40, I'll release it. because I think about that a lot. Didn't think about it growing up as much, but 20, 25, 30 years go by and you start thinking about, like you said, it was not a shared experience that a lot of people had. Yeah. A lot of us had compared to others. But now we have the opportunity to turn around. You said you have children. You have the opportunity to turn around and let them see that, number one, you can come up from nothing. And number two, just never take for granted what you have. So you're giving them a much better life than you started with already. That's not to say that your mother or my mother didn't give us a great... They did. They set us up wonderfully. But we just didn't have some of the things that other people are accustomed to. But you're already setting your children up with that. But they need to understand that, again, this is just the beginning for us, because even what we have in all of our trappings, there's still a discrepancy, a wealth gap that is tremendous. So our wealth, your wealth, my wealth can disappear in one single generation. We're gone. They're starting all over again. Whereas others, it's like, oh, well, here's this $800,000 house that I'm going to pass down to you.
Exactly.
Here, I'm going to pay for your college so you don't have student loan debt when you graduate for the next 30 years. Like, those are things that we didn't have, but hopefully we can start that for our kids. But then our kids understand that that's just still like you just took your first step on the ladder.
Yeah. That's definitely a conversation I find myself having with, friends from college, colleagues that have similar, backgrounds, but you kind of have this, it's a gift and a curse, because I can look at those experiences of, there were times you mentioned, going with clothes that have holes in them, having very humble experiences make you appreciate when you have the abundance of other things. And, like you said, like I can have pretty much anything I want for breakfast and I don't have to go that route. And, I think trying to instill that in our children is kind of like, it's a very difficult task to do, because you don't want to see your children suffer. But you also know that suffering yields a certain appreciation. And so it's like this balancing act that I find, me and my wife talk a lot about of, I want to be here for you and I want to give you more and put you in the position to exceed. But I also don't want you to take it for granted that it's always going to be here and you're always going to have that, because you're exactly right. This is something that could go away in the blink of a generation or in the blink of a missed opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. I don't have any children yet, but yeah, it's not something I wrestle with ahead of that. It's actually probably why I work at the full tilt that I do. Yeah. So I can be in a position. So I don't want them to struggle, as you said. I don't want them to struggle. I want them to understand struggle.
Yep. Yep. So that's a good transition point into your work life and what you're doing with Undock. So I would love it if you could just give the listeners a quick synopsis of, you know, kind of what you set out to do, where you are. I know this week was a big week for you. So if you could just share more there.
Absolutely. Yes, this week was a big week. We officially announced what it is we are truly building. We were in stealth for a little bit, but Undock is a calendar app, and the first piece that we released is something that helps you schedule your meetings. And right now it works in email, it'll work in LinkedIn and other websites and your mobile keyboard. And how it works is like autocomplete. So as you're typing inside of your email and you want to meet with someone, you just press the Undock key and we'll make a suggestion for the times that you are available. And that's based off of your schedule, your preferences, and your scheduling behavior, and whatever information we know about the other person. And if they're an Undock user, we'll pick the perfect time for you, or we'll suggest the perfect times for you based on their availability, your availability, their schedule, your schedule, and both of your preferences. And that can scale up to as many people as possible. If you're having a conversation with 8 people, it'll work just as fast to help you find the right time to meet. And there's a lot of subtle nuances into why it's just better and faster than anything that has been created in the past. And we're using quite a bit of AI for not just determining the time that we suggest for you, but also being able to help you interface with people that don't have Undock. So if somebody has another calendar application, let's say a Calendly or a HubSpot calendar, and they send you a link, we're also helping you process that to help you find mutual availability. So we're trying to build the most powerful calendar, and we're starting off with scheduling the most difficult part of meeting with other people.
Gotcha. So I'm curious, and I was, you know, speaking to founders, where did the idea come from, or where did the initial kernel of a thought of starting this endeavor, where did that start?
I can fortunately link it back to one phrase and one idea, but the product itself has gone through, I think, really two full iterations that are different. So I was running a few businesses and getting myself extremely busy, and I was not as available as I needed to be. And the particular moment that caused me to try to look for a solution first was I was in my office, I was on a call, and I had a call on hold. And then that was a very usual incident. And then a line of employees formed outside of my door. And that in that moment, I'm like, how am I going to even manage this situation right here? I'm wasting their time by sitting in queues waiting around for me, but they can't think of a better way because I'm always on the phone. I'm always getting calls, and there's always people in the office that needed my help. And part of that was because I was running 3 small-ish businesses, and pretty much all the hierarchy ran up to me, and I was the bottleneck for everything. So if I didn't put myself in that particular situation, maybe I wouldn't have been as inundated with requests for my time. But I first looked for software solutions out there to solve the problem. I didn't find anything. So I said, well, I'm going to build something at least for the people in my office. And I started building this thing, which I called the Presence Pod. And it was hooked up to an LED light, but it would show my employees in the office whether I'm on a call, whether I'm available, whether I'm in a meeting, whether I'm working on the task, or whether I'm free, or I don't want to be disturbed. And I started building that, and then I switched it to a different device and started building that. And then I was going to switch it again. And I thought, why don't I just do this online instead of trying to build this physical product, worry about hardware, distribution, all this other stuff. So I decided to build that same product online and then open it up to the rest of the world. So not just people in my office, but anyone could see if it's a good time to send me that email, make a phone call towards me, or in this case, if you're in my office, this is like 2016. No, it's 2017. If you're in the office, it's a good time to approach me for a chat. So that was the first iteration of it. And it connected to your phone system, your conferencing system, your calendar. And we were in the process of connecting to your project management system when the thought struck me, instant mutual availability is great. Solving availability at real time is a really hard problem, but it also is a problem in the calendaring space. So what if I took these same principles of, is this other person available now, and applied it to calendaring? Is this other person available on December 5th at 2 p.m.? All right. So we did that, and we built this gigantic monolithic app that had email built into it, had a phone system built into it, had a conferencing system built into it, had SMS built into it, had chat built into it. This is a huge, gigantic product. And I even got an email from an investor that was like, I saw your product on AngelList, because as soon as I registered the company, I put it on AngelList. And this was like a month later. It's like, it sounds like you're building some sort of like Sales IQ plus Calendly. Can you tell me a little bit more? I was like, yeah, but it does this, 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 this. He says, it sounds like you're building G Suite. he's like, and I'm not about to invest in somebody that's trying to go up against G Suite. And in my naivete, I was like, yeah, I am. And I will. And yeah, that's what we're going to do. Yeah. And we did that for, you know, another 6 or 7 months. I got some advice from accelerators that I did not get into. I was close to YC and Jason Calacanis' accelerator launch. They both gave me the same advice right around the same time. I applied and they both invited me for interviews within about a 3-week span. And I was by myself at that time. And they said, why don't you have a co-founder? And why haven't you launched? And also, you're building too much of a product. I was like, okay, let me go spend the next 6 months fixing all those things. So I slimmed down the product a little bit. I got myself a co-founder. And I launched an alpha, which still had a lot of the same stuff in it, but we slimmed it down quite a bit just to be a meeting product and a calendar product. And as we were, you know, iterating through that alpha phase, I said, you know, I'm going to apply, because I made a plan for myself. I learned a lot about venture capital in the years preceding, mainly through Jason Calacanis' podcast, which is why he was the first and for a while the only investor I'd ever emailed, because he, you know, put me on the game. I had no idea what venture capital really meant or how it worked. And just listening to his podcast and absorbing. Anyway, I had a plan that the best way for me as a black man, not from Stanford, Harvard, not from Silicon Valley, didn't work at Facebook, Apple, Google, to get into venture capital was to get into an accelerator first to get that rubber stamp of approval and then go after venture capital. But at the stage the business was in, I was kind of on the fence at that point because I had recruited a team. We had a little bit of revenue from the gigantic product that we were building before. And I felt like I could raise a little bit of money at a decent valuation. But I said, let me just do what I originally planned. I'm going to apply to one more accelerator. So it was the fourth accelerator that I applied to. The timing was right, and that was the Entrepreneurs Roundtable Accelerator here in New York. And I don't think they know this, but I was so on the fence about going to an accelerator. I started the application at like 11:20 and finished it at like 11:58, 2 minutes before it was due. And they liked the application, the responses, and they called us in. We had a couple of interviews, and they're like, well, you're building a lot. Are you sure you want to build all that? What about just slimming it down to this? And we slimmed it down even more and got into the accelerator. And yeah, so yeah. I can continue on from there. But
yeah, no, I think all that's super helpful. My wife is also a founder and has had to navigate the venture capital world she's a daughter of immigrant parents, coming into this not having the network to tap into, whether that be the Stanford, the Harvard, as you referenced, and not having the ability to call on your friends and family and do a couple $1 million angel round raise is something that I've seen firsthand that she's had to experience. And so I'm curious from your experience, like it sounds like there was a bit of persistence that you stayed in the game, and so that allowed you to pivot. It allowed you to change the scope of what you were building, and also, you know, bring in other perspectives that you're getting good advice on. But I'm curious, like, if someone were, they were thinking about following in the path, and they have a startup, or they're thinking about a startup, and they're thinking about going the VC route, what would be your, you know, couple nuggets of advice you'd give them based on your experience?
I've actually been having this conversation quite a bit lately, and the advice is kind of counter to what you would think it would be. And it's kind of the advice that I was given once we got into the accelerator. But only talk to investors when you know that you, your company, the market, all those things are ready, because otherwise it's largely going to be a waste of time. Most companies do not get funded at all. And Black, brown, and women founders get funded even less. So you really, really, really should be. It doesn't mean you're not going to get any investment or any checks, but wait until you are ready, right? So don't start your business and say, all right, I have my idea, I'm going to go out and raise some money to build it. Or don't build a prototype and not have like five people or something using it, and then say, I'm ready to build it, like, or to raise capital. So waiting for the timing to be right. And I was, I don't want to say I was stubborn about it, but I was incredulous that I was not ready, or people telling me that I was not ready. I was like, no, but look, I have revenue into the hundreds of thousands. I have a team. I have all this tech built out. We're filing a patent. Like, what do you mean we're not ready? You're not ready. I'm like, okay. So, because we were getting on occasion, and I, here's a tip. If you can get your .com, a six-letter English word, do that, and investors will have a little bit of faith in your ability to do things, I guess. I don't know. Because I solely attribute that. Because I just put a description on AngelList and our .com, and probably 10 to 15 investors in the first year or so when we were building quietly just reached out to us. Sometimes it took the conversation, sometimes it didn't, depending on like how the email exchanges went. But as we got into the accelerator, we were saying, hey, you know, like, you know, once a month some random investor reaches out to us and wants to have a conversation. And they're like, well, first of all, a lot of the big name investors aren't going to reach out to you unless they like know something or heard something. But even if they do, or it doesn't matter who it is, you're not ready to have these conversations. Your product is not ready. Your business model is not ready. Just wait. And I waited. So we got contacts from investors throughout the accelerator. And I felt I was burning my chances, as I was saying the line. We are heads down in product. We are not having any fundraising conversations at the moment for 4.5 months. Wow. And I think that was the right decision for us to wait until we were ready, because once we were ready, the conversations were completely different. The interest level went through the roof just from just learning how to talk about your business. Yeah. I say it all the time, was the most valuable part of the accelerator. Yes, there's a network and an introduction to investors, and they make you think about your business critically and all these other things, but learning how to talk about it for whichever audience you're trying to reach was critically important for me. So wait until you're ready to fundraise, and the signals can be different, but even if you know you need to fundraise to make your business successful, that is not the green light to start fundraising. Like, you want your fundraising process to be as condensed as possible and as intense as possible. So wait until you're ready, and then you can burn, you know, through 500, 1,000 invest, however many investors you may need to reach out to in a short period of time, and have your investment phase be, you know, 3 to 6 months instead of doing it as a trickle from day one. It does not make sense to do it that way.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. And I guess the one thing that came to mind as you were saying that is, especially as you mentioned, you know, founders of color, women founders, they may come into some of these rooms, you know, whether it be physical or virtual, with a little bit of imposter syndrome. So yeah. I'm curious, how do you balance that with being ready and not questioning yourself? And like, is there like signals, or there things that like, okay, this is go time that you would recommend? Because I just know, you know, that can also play into people's own perception of when ready truly is.
Yes. So that's something that's a self-defeating, and you bring it on yourself, the imposter syndrome. But other times, like, you're sitting in the room, and like for the first wave of investors, is like every single person was a white male. I can't remember how many investors I met before I even met a female, a VC, let alone a person of color. And that can automatically make you feel like an imposter, because you are the stranger in the room, the stranger for all the conversations, in all of the conversations. So it's tough to overcome. And we had that moment. Well, let's say inside of the team, the first couple of weeks that we went out to fundraise after our demo day, it was the, looking back at it now, I know it was the wrong investors reaching out to us at the wrong stage. Mm-hmm. But every single one of them almost said, too early, too early, too early, too early, to the point one of my co-founders said, you know, we've been hearing this for 2 weeks straight. I think they're right. I think we're just too early to fundraise. Maybe we should wait until October. And I was like, no, I know the time is now. This is the time. And then we pushed forward, and literally like a week later, the tide just completely turned. And once we got the first few yeses, it was like a snowball effect. It was yes, 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 yes. And we ended up having over 130 investor meetings, and all but two of them were inbound investor meetings. So it was intense, again, and condensed. And that's why I think we're able to be successful in a short amount of time doing that.
Cool. No, yeah. Congrats to you for having that persistence to know that you were ready and to hang in there. Cause I know that it's been described as being a founder is one of the loneliest jobs you can ever have. So I can't imagine the fortitude you had to build. I'm sure some of that goes back to your upbringing, which I would love it, you know, from switching a little bit to the brand of Nash for a bit. How would you describe yourself? And, you know, if you had three words, or if you had to, you know, put a phrase to you as a brand.
The first word that I thought of is not generally used as a positive attribute, but I think it is a positive attribute for myself, and that's quixotic. And Don Quixote is actually one of my favorite books. I have like three different copies of it. And I mean, really, the story is about a man that had a lifelong ambition of doing something, in this case, obtaining knighthood. And in his later years, he just becomes delusional to most people. And, you know, that's kind of the perception that most people have about your business. Even like your friends are like, oh yeah, cool, you're working on an app, good luck with that, right? That is the outward perception that most people have. Mm-hmm. But you kind of have to have that dogged pursuit and belief that whatever it is that you're chasing, in this case, it's not windmills and dragons, but it's building the next Google, building the next Microsoft. So definitely quixotic in the, like, that is chasing like something that's very, 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 very hard to obtain. And most people would, even if they don't say it, they would say you're insane to think that you can do that. Right. Yep. Well, that's quixotic. Tied to that, I am indefatigable. Like, I do not tire. I cannot be, I mean, I'd make it sound, you know, too much bravado there, but I have limitless energy mentally, physically, somehow. I don't know how, because I don't take care of myself physically all that well. I don't sleep. I don't eat. I do exercise on occasion, but not in this quarantine. I have not been, but I think having unlimited energy is another good quality. And I would say pattern recognition is something that's actually really, really strong for me. And that pattern recognition goes from like, oh, figuring out code, to figuring out design, to figuring out business model, to figuring out team, to figuring out, you know, who you're hiring and what, to figuring out. I just think my ability to recognize patterns and put things together has been really extremely helpful for me in these endeavors. So,
no, that is truly fascinating how you methodically walk through all three of those, because one, I love the fact that you started by saying, you know, this isn't thought of as positive, because these things make you up and make you a success don't necessarily have to be from a positive, you know, perception, if you will. But if you can combine them to become superpowers for you, that's truly all that matters. And then I think the other thing, I also studied computer science in school. I quickly realized that I was not cut out for a life of programming and coding, and transitioned into marketing as my trade. But it's funny, when I look back to you mentioned pattern recognition. That's definitely something that comes a little bit easier to me. And there has to be something in that from the CS or the coding background to be able to take those skills and apply them in a different way. So I'm glad you called that out.
Yeah, 100%. I pegged that way too late, and I wish I was more engaged in my computer science learnings, but it just makes you think about problems differently. Like, if you're a person that's never looked at code in any way, shape, or form, like, you just don't think about things in a structured way that you have to think about when you're coding. And I attribute that to how I'm able to problem solve. Like, we're doing things, and it'll become more apparent as the next, you know, 3 months go by, 6 months. We're doing things that, if the people in the competitive companies had the right type of person in the product department, it would have done it already. But some of it's like, it's so obvious that it should be done this way. Why has no one done it this way? And it's because they're not thinking about either the problem set or the solution set in the right manner. And I think thinking about things as much as possible semantically as a coder would is very beneficial.
Yeah, definitely. So looking back at your career to date, or looking back at your experiences, have you had a "Mama, we made it" moment?
Taking a deep pause on that, because I'd like to say yes, I've had a couple "we made it" moments. So in a couple of the previous companies, one big projects, like, I've done work at like airports and for municipalities, police departments, fire departments, all other stuff. We did have an $800,000, like a single deal that went through for $800,000. Like, oh, okay, all right, that was pretty good. But then there was this contract that we won, which is bittersweet. It was a contract that was going to be worth I don't think I've actually said the number. Well, I already started $250 million over 9 years. And we started working on that project. And that was the, like, oh, I need to shift everything around. All right, so I'm going to start planning here. Like, okay, like, I have to do this over here. I got to, like, you start thinking, like, I'm set. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And worked on that project for a few months and ended up getting scammed out of a lot of money. And I was already starting Undock at that time. And I was also starting another business called Patched at that time. And I was running two other businesses at that time, really three. Wow. Other businesses at that time. And I was in real estate, right? So at that moment, I was like, it's go time. I'm going to be able to do and execute on all the things that I want. And I don't even need to complete this whole contract. Like, doing this contract and making a couple million dollars for myself in like a year or so will literally allow me to do anything that I wanted to do. Yeah. And it fell apart in 3 months. Yeah. And that was the, like, the pinnacle. I've been working at that company and that business for 6.5 years at that point. And I was like, yes, it all paid off. I knew it was going to pay off. Here it is. This is what's supposed to happen. And that was the "Mama, I made it" moment, but it fell through and I put my head down. And I tried to fix that business and didn't work out. And I ended up dropping that business and another business in April of last year and started working on Undock full time. And I would say that the round that we just raised would be a "Mama, we made it" moment, but it's not for me, because I understand at this level, in this market, in these days and times, what we raised is peanuts, and it'll evaporate in 18 months. And I need to get to that next level. Yeah. Before I can even say that, oh, we're here now. Undock.com is here, right? So, and we're close to doing that. I had a kind of a gut check moment this summer, because as the round was getting ready to close, everyone else wanted to participate in the round, and they wanted to put together, they being either existing or new investors, wanted to put together a larger round. And I said no. All right. So it was a bet on what the business would do over the next 6 months or so, and bet on what I think is a defining moment in work, that we're not coming back to the office in full capacity. We'll go back in some capacity. We're not going back to the office in full capacity. And that just makes a larger need for my product. And I also, like I said, have a couple of things in stealth that we have not released. And it was a bet on all of those things, the perfect confluence of events for early next year, making the next round much more attractive and palatable for me and the rest of the team. So that is going to be the mama, we made it moment that actually works out. So
yeah, no. Look forward to hearing and seeing that one. Before we close out, I want to have a little bit of fun. So when they turned your life story into a movie, who would you want to play you on the big screen?
Oh, I know it's like, what's his name? Daniel Kiwanuka or something like that. The guy from Get Out.
Yeah.
He's pretty dope. He has a British accent, though. I heard that. I was like, whoa, that's not what I expected. Yeah. Yeah, he's good, though. And he kind of looks like me. So it'll be good.
Nice. He's got some range. What would the trailer of that movie communicate?
I think it would have to go back to being the Don Quixote of the 2020s. Just navigating, just trying to build the biggest business possible as undeterred underdog. That would definitely have to be the narrative. Like, this guy is just completely happy and delusional as he's trying to climb the highest mountain, and I'm gonna watch because it's interesting.
Right? Well, those things kind of have to go together. You have to be, part of being happy is being delusional and seeing the thing that no one else can see. So, yeah. So I'm a huge fan of stories. It's why I started the podcast. I love to hear from others. Who would be the three people you would want to sit down with, whether it be on podcast or other, and hear their firsthand story? They could be with us. They could have passed. But who are your three?
That's a good one. Buckminster Fuller would be one. Just a great, now I'm going to have two designers in my list, which is kind of weird. Buckminster Fuller and Dieter Rams, just legendary, like groundbreaking in terms of design and aesthetic. And they did it in a 50s, 60s era. And I think for me, and I've been wrestling with this, and maybe I shouldn't put this out there, but I will. I think for me and the company that we're building, figuring out the user experience beyond solving all these hard problems, which we're doing, I think figuring out the user experience in this decade is going to be what is the difference between us being a really good company, a really big company, and a generational company. So those are some inspirations for me. And I think, I want to think of like a problem solver that's interesting to me. All right, I'll throw a cliche out there, Elon Musk. yeah. I've come close to brushing elbows with him, and he, maybe not him directly, but I took a trip to SpaceX shortly before launching or starting seriously on Undock, and that was at a satellite launch. All the way in there. And that was in that moment, I said, if they described launching a satellite as a rocket, which contains satellites, as a sequence of a million miracles in a row. And I'm like, all right, if they can literally heap thousands of pounds of metal into space and then bring it back, I can do a tech startup.
Yeah.
Totally cool. So I want to dig in on somebody who is thinking like I'm going to Mars. Like he's thinking I'm going to Mars and he means it, right? Yeah. So getting inside of that type of thinking would be interesting. Like the character, and I think he does the character thing just to be funny. So, although other people have different thoughts about that, but yeah. Those are three for me.
Gotcha.
So all cool. People who can inspire me to build an awesome product.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So is there anything I didn't ask that you want to share or anything you want to ask me?
Can I add somebody to my list?
Yeah.
Harriet Tubman. Huh. Yeah, for
way
sure.
Way to round it out.
Yeah. Yeah. She's, I mean, just where you talk about, you know, grounding yourself and having perspective, that is the ultimate perspective because number one, she lived a very, very hard life, but then saw again, there is a free world out there for us and I'm going to take you to it. So that is the ultimate moonshot, you know. Anyway, so you said, do I have any questions for you?
Yeah. Anything you want to ask me or anything else you want to share?
I'm going to get dark. What is your biggest daily struggle mentally? What are you trying to overcome? What is the hurdle?
Interesting. So this is one of my core values is efficiency. And it comes to life through different parts of who I am. One of the things I fundamentally believe is that we're always trying to balance energy, energy in, energy out. And if we can get that optimal balance, we can do more. And so for me, like inefficient things just drive me crazy. And it's everything from like major inefficiencies. So like, for instance, my wife took our oldest to the dentist and they had like a 2-hour wait. And I'm like, we set an appointment. Why would you have a 2-hour wait? Like those things really get to me. But then even the small things of like, oh my gosh, I left this thing here and I got to go back upstairs and like, you know, have negative distance, et cetera. So I would say I spend most of my day trying to be more efficient. And the pandemic and the, you know, stay at home and the quarantining has thrown that out the window. Like I just have had to let go of some of that because we are no longer in the world of being productive. We're in the world of taking care of ourselves and maintaining. So I would say that's probably the one I'm dealing with now is just like, how do I deal with this thing that's like a core principle of who I am, but knowing that ultimately like it's going to be okay. And I don't have to, you know, squeak out all the efficiencies in my life across the facets of everything we do.
Do you mind if I ask a follow-up to that?
Yeah. Yeah.
So in any way, do you see the pandemic, even though we're all going through it globally, could you possibly see it as something that you're suffering through on your own? And maybe not necessarily on your own is not the best way to say it, but it is a suffering time for you. Do you see it as an opportunity to, you know, like we grew up, we were in a dark or hard and tough times and we rose up through that. Do you see this as another opportunity to do that? Because actually I do see that. I see the pandemic like going into this just weird living situation around the world coming out. I see the whole entire period as dark, dark, dark times, but I have an opportunity to work through these dark times and come out on the end on top and make it a positive story. Is that something you feel?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I had a conversation, I don't know if it was on the podcast or elsewhere now that I think about it, but someone, you know, similarly said getting married, it shows you who you are. And not necessarily that you need to get married to figure out who you are, but like being within a partnership with someone, it just amplifies what you already are. And I feel like to your question about the pandemic and, you know, quarantine and all that kind of stuff, it's amplifying what's already in us and the anxieties we have, the difficulties we have, the things we struggle with. Like we don't have anywhere to go and we can't, you know, I think back to March and April, like when things shut down, like you didn't have any distractions and you didn't have any ways to take away like, oh, I got to go do this. I can't worry about that right now. And so I do think that there's a level of we're all going through it, but we're experiencing it differently because we all have different hangups and we all have different things that we need to work through on so many levels. And so I would 100% agree that I am definitely experiencing it differently than everyone else, even though there's probably things I can relate to others on. There's other things that we have shared experiences with. But I would say that I'm hopefully applying it in a way that, you know, when things, quote unquote, get back to a normal, it may not be the previous normal, but a normal, that I've learned things or there's lessons that I can apply. You know, we have a young daughter that she turned one at the beginning of this, and just being able to be present for those life moments, like that was the one that I really, you know, I don't take for granted, because in a traditional world, I'd have been spending an hour commuting in, an hour commuting back, and spending hours and hours in an office. And I would have missed so many of those small moments that I don't take for granted. I think that that's definitely been a kind of a shining light throughout all this. But yeah, I agree that we should come through this better than we entered it, if we can all agree that it's showcasing and amplifying what we already struggled with. But yeah, fascinating question.
Well, that's a trip. And some of the things that you said there kind of put a button on it for me. So I'm kind of now picturing, because you said we're all going through this together, but we're kind of going through it alone. I'm picturing, like, people have been in isolation. A lot of people have been in real isolation. It's almost like you put the entire world or large swaths of the world in solitary confinement for some period of time. And everybody behaves differently when they first come out and see the light. Mm-hmm. So I think after the pandemic, everybody's going to have a different perspective on literally everything. Like, you can't spend that much time in one place or by yourself, or even if it's the same people you're nesting with, a group of people, you can't spend that much time in isolation and not come out with a different perspective.
100%.
Yeah. Cool.
So before I let you go, where should I send listeners that want to either connect with you, they want to find out more about what you're doing? Where's the best place to send them?
Undock.com is the best place to find anything about what I'm building. That's the only thing I work on now, undock.com. And we're also on social, either Undock on some of the platforms, or it's Undock HQ. And you can find me on all the platforms as Nash Theory.
Cool. I'll include that in the show notes. Well, listen, this has been super interesting. I've learned a lot. Hopefully everyone that's listening has some takeaways that they can hopefully put into their journey. So I appreciate you for sharing your story and letting us in.
Matt, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of What's Your Story podcast. If you enjoyed it, please hit subscribe, leave us a review, and share with someone else you think might also enjoy it. And if you're interested in keeping up with all things stories and marketing and inclusive leadership, head over to mattestory.com/download to sign up for my monthly newsletter. Until next time, keep sharing your story.